From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The big media story this week involves John McCain and the New York Times. Here's MSNBC's Keith Olbermann, ABC's Jake Tapper, and Fox's John Gibson.
Our fifth story on the countdown, Vicky Gate, the Eisman Trophy, the smear of the century, the scandal with no scandal there. You take your pick for the title.
It's exactly the last kind of story a presidential candidate wants on the front page of major newspapers, let alone a candidate who prides himself on ethics, integrity, and standing up to special interests.
The story has a lot of innuendo, very little proof. So in the end, will it hurt the Times more than it will hurt McCain?
The story, published in Thursday's paper, based largely on the testimony of unnamed former McCain staffers, suggests that some years back, the senator had grown too close to lobbyist Vicky Eisman. Those staffers reportedly confronted Eisman about the relationship, and even McCain himself, a claim he denies. The story also suggests that McCain may have done favors for at least one of Eisman's clients. The piece was the latest in a Times series about the lives of the candidates called The Long Run. Serious questions were asked, but few definitive answers supplied. The Republican National Committee answered by instantly firing off emails to open the pockets of the faithful, uniting them in their shared loathing of the Gray Lady. Even as vigorous a McCain basher as Rush Limbaugh knew a common enemy when he saw one.
You are a Republican, and at some point, the people you cozy up to, either to do legislation or to get cozy media stories, are going to turn on you. They are snakes.
Some critics and pundits have defended the Times, but many others have charged the paper with serving up thin gruel based largely on the testimony of anonymous, quote, disillusioned staffers. The biggest complaint levied by journalism watchdogs centered on the paper's reliance on unnamed sources. Times executive editor Bill Keller spoke to NPR's David Folkenflik.
Obviously, you would like to have not just on the record sources, but documentary evidence for everything you put in the newspaper. But if you refuse to publish stories that included anonymously sourced information, most of the important things we know about, you know, how our country is run would not get reported.
The Times policy states that when using anonymous sources, quote, we accept an obligation not only to convince the reader of their reliability, but also to convey what we can learn of their motivation. We spoke to Al Siegel, one of the authors of the Times policy, in 2004.
The more important the information is, the more tolerant we have to be about the inability to put names on it. And then there are public relations people who are just trying to cover their backs sometimes when they won't let you use their names. And there we quite simply should refuse to take information.
So how important is this particular information? Important enough to create a cloud of compromise over a candidate running on the issue of character? Important enough to risk a great newspaper's reputation? Here's MSNBC's Chris Matthews.
The story here is that John McCain had an affair with a lobbyist and did favors for her. And that is a problem for him if that's true. If it's not true, it's not a problem for him. It's a problem for the New York Times.
As Tom Rosensteel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, observed, we are not in an age of trust me journalism. We're not. We are in an age of challenge-me journalism and check-me journalism. Subsequent reporting by other news outlets has begun to accumulate and quantify McCain's connections with lobbyists. There are many. As for the romantic relationship the piece alluded to, that seems to be a story for another day. Or never. The Times seems to have decided that compelling political journalism must go beyond facts and airtight conclusions, that important insights come from just telling stories and letting the public fill in the blanks. But those blanks leave a great deal of space for error and confusion. The story ran on Thursday under the headline, For McCain, Self-Confidence on Ethics Poses Its Own Risks. The same could be said for the New York Times itself.
Don't tell me words don't matter. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, just words.
The oratorical stylings, ladies and gentlemen, of Barack Obama. He'll be here all week. Every week, maybe for years, because largely on the strength of his rhetorical gifts and his ability to inspire audiences, young and old, black and white, rich and poor, he has become the Democratic frontrunner in the race for the presidency. Unless something should bring him suddenly down, like, say, a charge of plagiarism.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That voice, of course, was not Obama, but Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, who had used the just words in a speech 16 months before the senator. Patrick says he was not victimized because the phrasing was his suggestion for Obama to challenge charges of empty rhetoric, and anyway, Obama had credited him for it in the past. Furthermore, it's a bit absurd when a politician must answer to charges that his speechwriters stole from another politician's speechwriters. But not so absurd that it didn't torpedo Senator Joe Biden's presidential aspirations in 1987 when he was caught claiming a British parliamentarian's anecdote as his own. And thus was the Hillary Clinton campaign ready at the torpedo bay.
You know, lifting whole passages from someone else's speeches is not change you can believe in. It's change you can Xerox. And I just don't think...
Xerox. Nice line. I wonder who in the Clinton campaign came up with it. It's not as though modern politicians spend a lot of time scribbling Abraham Lincoln-like on the back of envelopes to prepare for the young Democrats of Waxahachie or whatever. They have people for that, and have had for a long time.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
In the teeth of the Great Depression, 1933, this was perhaps Franklin Delano Roosevelt's most famous utterance. But he didn't write it. Historians attribute it to FDR advisor Louis Howe, who himself perhaps borrowed it from Henry David Thoreau or the Duke of Wellington or from 16th century French philosopher Michel de Montaigne or, as some have suggested, from an ad for a Washington, D.C. department store. Now listen to this familiar quotation.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
That was John F. Kennedy at his 1961 inaugural, speaking the words that would define his presidency. But according to Jerry Doolittle, a speechwriter for President Jimmy Carter, Kennedy advisor Ted Sorensen cribbed that idea from a 1916 address by Warren G. Harding, whose own people found it who knows where.
You know, probably originally came from the demotic Greek, I imagine, but, you know, speech is a long kind of never-ending tapestry of what you say and what I say and what a million other people say. And, you know, once you start pulling at the thread in political oratory, you find that it's all connected.
Connected threads or no, in journalism, literature, and scholarly writing, borrowing text unattributed is unequivocally a crime.
But the question is, do those same norms apply to political speeches? And, you know, you'd have to be crazy to think that.
Ethicist Ed Wasserman is a professor at Washington and Lee University.
Political speech writing is a collaboration among a number of people. If we were being honest about it, at the end of the State of the Union address, they'd roll the credits.
Consider this immortal moment from President Ronald Reagan, the great communicator.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. That doesn't sound like a speech line. It really sounds like something spontaneous. The final anger of an anti-communist like Reagan after decades of frustration, he gets to tell the Soviet Union what he really thinks of them.
Biographer Douglas Brinkley is a distinguished professor of history at Rice University.
But that line was penned by a man named Peter Robinson. The reason that we're not so focused on Peter Robinson is because Reagan's utterance of it is what's memorable. And that's why presidents get the credit. In the end, they have to put the entire credibility of the United States on the line when they speak, and the words that they say carry the power of America.
Precisely. Political oratory, as Barack Obama correctly reminds us, is not just words. It is the convergence of text, of the underlying ideas, of performance, and of the speaker's own authority, not to mention place and time. According to Brinkley, Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech for the 1963 March on Washington made no splash whatsoever when he delivered it in Detroit 2 months earlier. Yet on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, he held the crowd and the world in his thrall. 250,000 mesmerized marchers, blissfully uninterested in who wrote what when. This gets to another peculiarity of political rhetoric, the audience's willing suspension of disbelief. Ted Widmer, director of the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University, is a scholar on presidential oratory.
For the average audience member, the moment is everything, and you think that this is the first time this speech has been given, and you might even think the speaker is speaking to you directly, and that is something the speaker wants you to feel. They want it to be as exciting a moment as possible.
But it is for this very reason, Widmer believes, that Obama puts himself at risk by not being more scrupulous about the language and ideas he implicitly takes credit for.
Democracy and liberty and freedom, there are only so many concepts out there, and it's hard to always think of new ways of talking about them. But when you get into long sentences and even paragraphs that have been lifted wholesale from another speech, then that becomes very dangerous.
For one thing, the victimless crime isn't victimless at all if the audience feels hoodwinked, whereupon an eloquent, inspiring, fresh, original messenger of hope might begin looking like just another glib politician and wind up, like Biden, victim himself. On the other hand, surely there are times when the plagiarism police should just look the other way. For instance, Obama's overall campaign theme, Yes, We Can. It was used by farm workers organizer Cesar Chavez in the early 70s. It's the title of a book for colostomy patients. And as every kindergartner knows, it is the inviolable watchword of Bob the Builder. And so I asked Widmer what risk Obama is taking by sloganeering with the categorically unoriginal Yes, We Can.
Well, it's a much better slogan than No, We Can't.
God, I wish I'd said that.
Coming up, the serious business of turning candidates into jokes.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Whether it's a political position, a mistake in one's personal life, or just a silly mannerism, editorial cartoons are supposed to mock politicians and portray them in an unflattering light. But when the two remaining Democratic presidential nominees are an African-American and a woman, editorial cartoonists presumably don't want their caricatures to stand out for appearing racist or sexist. Nick Anderson is a cartoonist at the Houston Chronicle and president of the Association of American Editorial Cartoonists, and he joins me now. Nick, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
Cartoons are often unflattering. They seize upon prominent features, a big nose, a crooked smile, and they tend to make it larger or more prominent. When you're dealing with a woman and an African-American, do you think your colleagues feel fettered in any way lest exaggeration turns into something, I don't know, more pernicious?
Well, I don't know. Maybe subconsciously. We do have a history where blacks were depicted in very grotesque ways. So maybe it is subconscious, and it's something I can honestly say I hadn't overtly thought about. With Hillary, I am more aware of it, and that's where I have gotten a few more complaints. And I've got to say, I think the double standard exists with the readers more than with the cartoonists. I do some animated editorial cartoons here, and my character of Hillary Clinton raised the ire of one of my colleagues, and she actually blogged about it. And I didn't mind her doing it. I thought it was kind of fun to play it out publicly. But she didn't like that Hillary's hips were drawn wide. But you know, I draw Dick Cheney like a cave troll, so I think I was being pretty even-handed in my attempt to portray both of them.
Let me ask you this. I mean, you have personally depicted President Bush as a monkey.
Right. A little girl asked me, why do you draw him like a monkey? And I said, I don't make him look like a monkey. God made him look like a monkey.
But you know, I think it's fair to say that nobody is going to make Barack Obama look like a monkey, because no matter what one saw in one's mind's eye, you simply couldn't. It would be racially, grotesquely offensive.
Absolutely. There would be racial baggage attached to that. So if I were tempted, I would in that case have to pull my punches. It's never crossed my mind. I don't think he looks like a monkey. when I look at Barack Obama, I think he's relatively handsome, and I, you know, in an objective manner. So I try to capture that charisma that he seems to have, rather than portray him as really unflattering. I try to exaggerate without losing that essential quality.
You've made the point that you are not employing a double standard. If you draw Dick Cheney as a troll, you should be free to draw Hillary Clinton as you see her. But, you know, the society does have a double standard, and physical appearance for women is simply different than it is for men, and the freedom to ridicule it, it seems to me, in polite company is different for women than it is for men. So, you know, where does that leave the cartoonist?
I think you make a valid point. I just don't think that editorial cartoons should be the province of polite company. I think we have to have some awareness of racial history and gender history, but I think editorial cartoonists are the last people that should be pulling their punches. And although I think you're right, we do as a society have double standards for the physical features of women, especially of weight, I just don't think that in this case it has gone into the territory where I think it's inappropriate.
So in the event that Hillary Clinton wins the Democratic nomination and is elected president, you think it's a good bet that in your cartoons, by the end of her first term, her jowls will reach the knees of her pantsuit in your cartoons?
I think it's entirely possible. But what happens with a president is they almost become beyond a caricature. They become recognized by a few simple visual tells. With Bush, it's the ears and the space between his nose and mouth. I think my caricature of him probably looks less like him today than it did when I first started drawing him, but it's become almost a caricature of a caricature. And if she becomes president, I am curious to see where that caricature will go for all of us.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Nick Anderson is editorial cartoonist at the Houston Chronicle. Of course, a woman has been on the Democratic ticket before. In 1984, Geraldine Ferraro was Walter Mondale's running mate. And according to editorial cartoon historian Elaine Miller, cartoonists took the mate in Running Mate quite literally.
They were portrayed relentlessly as a couple, sometimes a married couple, sometimes a bride, a sweetheart, and more sort of unprintable types of images. And Ferraro told me in an interview that their campaign had very strict directives to not touch, to not hug, certainly not kiss, to have no physical contact that might lend itself to that sort of interpretation.
And yet the couple's imagery in the cartooning persisted. Do you suppose that was because of some sort of embedded sexism, because of poverty of imagination? To what do you attribute this phenomenon?
Well, Tom Tolles, who's now with the Washington Post, he observed this is the first time that cartoonists are really seeing this phenomenon. And so they're reaching out for whatever kinds of images are readily available to them. I like to say that cartoonists mine the metaphors of the social landscape. So many of them, of course, reached out and portrayed them as a couple. It was readily available imagery.
Now, you've made quite a study of Hillary Clinton and her portrayals in editorial cartoons. Let's go back to when she was first lady, or at least wife of the candidate for the presidency. How was she first introduced to the world via editorial cartoons?
The cartoons very quickly began to portray her as the stronger of the two, inappropriately involved in government. She was not an elected official, and she began to be portrayed as wearing the pants. And, for example, the cartoonist would have Bill playing the saxophone, but Hillary reaching around from behind him, depressing the keys.
And now that she is the candidate, how has her image evolved in cartoons?
She's being portrayed much in the same way, too masculine, too shrill. There's a lot of attention to her clothing and some ridicule of the pantsuit. I heard a quip that her official airplane is called Pantsuit One. Now, of course, it's logical to critique her positions on things, but so many of the cartoons really rely on physical portrayals that are really quite harsh. Ones that have her going off to a beauty parlor saying, please give me a good face. And to portray a woman as unattractive really has a different impact than doing the same with a man. There is an asymmetry there in the consequence or the impact of doing that.
Elaine, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Elaine Miller is a professor of women's studies, foreign languages, and literatures at the State University of New York College at Brockport.
Cartoonists are not the only ones struggling with the complexities of portraying certain candidates this election season. So are comics. Just before the writers' strike, the cast of NBC's Saturday Night Live staged a Halloween party thrown by the Clintons.
Hillary, thank you so much for throwing this Halloween party.
John Edwards, I'm so glad you came. I just thought it would be good for all of us Democrats to get together after Tuesday's debate.
We also saw comics playing Bill Richardson, Joe Biden, and Christopher Dodd, Dennis Kucinich, even Mike Gravel. As for Barack Obama, he played himself.
So you dressed as yourself?
Well, you know, Hillary, I have nothing to hide. I enjoy being myself. I'm not going to change who I am just because it's Halloween.
Well, that's great.
Seth Meyers is head writer as well as cast member of Saturday Night Live. We spoke to him Thursday because we learned that after holding auditions, SNL had finally found its in-house Obama to debut this weekend. For a while, he was looking like cast member Maya Rudolph.
Maya was our sort of like, we were considering her as a potential break glass in case of emergency situation. If we really came down to the point where we needed to do something and didn't have a fallback plan.
Let me ask you about your Hillary Clintons, played by Amy Poehler.
Should I be unable to run again in 2016, and should one or all of you, my former fellow candidates, then decide to make a second, this time more realistic, bid for the White House? Well, I think that would be just super.
Some people's impressions are based on how they look, and other people can get the sound down. You know, other people just sort of get the essence of somebody. I think, you know, she is approaching it more from the sort of attitude of Hillary Clinton. You know, someone like Daryl Hammond is obviously sort of a magician with his voice.
Yeah.
He can sort of find the way people sound.
His Clinton is amazing.
Campaign? That's not why I'm here. I'm in Florida because these hurricanes have put a lot of trailer park ladies on the street. And the only thing better than a trailer park girl is one that is desperate.
His Clinton is amazing. But again, he can't play Hillary Clinton, so we had to go in another direction there.
Now, maybe this is the wrong question to direct to the head writer of Saturday Night Live, but some have said the problem with depicting Hillary and depicting Obama is that the sorts of characteristics that you would exaggerate in a white man become fraught with racial or gender implications when you apply those same tricks of the trade to depicting a black man or a woman.
Well, you know, I think that's a fair thing. And I think, you know, we have to take that under consideration. Of course, obviously, we're not going to exaggerate things in ways that people might find offensive or anything like that. But at the same time, if you worry about that too much in comedy, you handcuff yourself.
But did you find Obama harder than most simply because he didn't have any obvious quirk, or were there other considerations?
You can sound a lot like Obama and you can act a lot like Obama. The real question for us and the issue that's more on the writing side than actually the impersonation side is, how are you going to write it funny? Because up to this point, you know, there's not that much to exaggerate about him. For us, a lot of times, you know, humor comes from exaggeration. Daryl's Bill Clinton, you exaggerate the charm. With Will Ferrell's early George Bush impression, you sort of exaggerated the silliness.
So how are we all doing out there, huh? Yeah, not so good. I broke the Hoover Dam. We had that war thing happen. But I mean, whoever heard of a civil war anyway? What is that?
And, you know, I don't think we quite know yet which way we're going to exaggerate the Obama.
Yeah, it's a pretty potent political statement when you think about it. When you go back to Rich Little's, you know, Nixon's I Am Not a Crook,
mm-hmm.
It was his mendacity and his general sort of sweaty suspiciousness.
Right.
When you go to Dana Carvey's brilliant depiction of Bush Sr., it was his general wishy-washiness, the kind of thing that Doonesbury also sent up.
As commander in chief, I am ever cognizant of my authority to launch a full-scale orgy of death there on the desert sand. Probably won't, but then again, I might.
So when you decide to do a candidate, and I guess in the case of Hillary, it was her insistence that this job was hers, that she deserved it, that she'd worked for it, and that it ought to be bestowed on her, that sort of preternatural confidence,
yes,
that Amy Poehler was going for. Also a potent political statement. So then when you come to Obama, do you do hope?
I mean, I think the same way that the media has an issue with Obama right now, which is everybody really likes him, but you know, if you dig really deep, I don't think anybody really knows that much about him. So that's sort of the trick we're having as well, because the issue as well is, you know, we don't really have to crack who a candidate is. We have to crack how people see the candidate.
Mm-hmm.
We're sort of a mirror on the already projected perception of the people who watch our show.
And so once you have the Obama nailed down, will you just draw a huge sigh of relief?
Yes, absolutely. And I will say, I'm going to throw this out there to the candidate, anytime he wants to come back and play himself on the show, it would solve everybody's problems.
Seth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Seth Meyers is the head writer at Saturday Night Live. This weekend, they debut their Barack Obama. The typeface chosen for a logo can define a brand. Just think of Coca-Cola or FedEx or Google. But what about the brands known as Clinton, Obama, and McCain? How much attention do their campaigns give to the marketing muscle of the humble font? And with the rise of the web as a campaign tool, should they be giving more? Sam Burlow, general manager of Boston-based design firm The Font Bureau, which has developed typefaces for companies including Apple Computer and The New York Times, analyzed the candidates' logos for the Boston Globe. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Hello, Brooke.
When we talk about logos, we often talk about serif and sans serif fonts. What are those?
A serif font has little feet at the end of the vertical characters, whereas a sans serif, something you'd see like in the Best Buy logo, big, strong, bold. There's less contrast between the thick and the thin strokes of the letters.
Do you think that typefaces really say anything about the candidates?
I think they say quite a bit. If you look at Bush Quail, Quail is a very, very thin, spindly serif typeface, and the Bush is a very strong sans serif, and it's set really big. I think that said a lot about that campaign. The Bush Cheney was great. It just had that incredible NASCAR feel with the slanted sans serif saying, "We're going really fast. Hang on." If you look at Hillary's campaign, it's really a throwback to Reagan and Bush. It has that feeling of old typography from the 70s and 80s. It's serif. It's sort of high-waisted, as if the lowercase, the pants have been pulled up too high. Feels sort of like a bad Talbot suit. Doesn't quite fit right.
What is the typeface that Hillary uses?
Oh, geez. The typophiles will talk about this for months on the blogs. I believe that it's a Baskerville, but it looks like the lowercase R's sort of been punched in the nose, and the lowercase has been jacked up a little bit to make it feel a little bit bigger and stronger.
If you liken Hillary's typeface to a Talbot suit, what sort of suit do you think it ought to be wearing, and which font will get you there?
Well, I think something more like the Wall Street Journal fonts. That typeface is called Escrow. It was done especially for the Wall Street Journal. It's very classy and very clean. It has much more contrast between the thick and the thin strokes.
What kind of a suit?
More of a Brooks Brothers suit.
Now, let's talk about Obama's. You think his is pretty hip and cool, right?
I do. They made big, beautiful posters that would say, "South Carolina loves Obama." Headline set in a very classy sans serif font called Gotham. It's very clean. It doesn't have any lumps or big balls at the end of the characters. It sort of ends very crisply, like a manicured set of nails, very metrosexual.
If it were a suit, what would it be?
Armani.
Now, you say that Huckabee's design is cluttered and confusing. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there are several oddities about the Huckabee design. The six stars that are sort of floating down like snowflakes are a bit odd. And the swash that reminds me of Coca-Cola. And then there's this yellow element in the type. The only yellow that I could find in the past was Nixon Lodge and Goldwater, which puts him in interesting company. And then the type itself is squished together very tightly and artificially bolded. as if they had so much they had to get on the page, like family and faith and freedom, as if the other candidates don't believe in those three things.
So what do you think would work better?
Well, if it didn't look like a Daytona 500 car, that would be a good start.
So what's your favorite logo of the candidates still in the race?
I think the McCain is fantastic. The star with the yellow bars clearly says he's a general, he's in charge.
So is this a serif or a sans serif font?
Well, it's interesting. It's in between, Brooke. It's
it's a moderate serif?
It's a down the middle of the aisle serif. It has elements of a sans serif, but the ends of the strokes flare out a little bit.
So it's a nod to the serif crowd without a complete capitulation.
It's a typeface that can talk to Feingold and can talk to Bob Dole at the same time.
Sam, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Sam Berlow is general manager of the Font Bureau.
Coming up, the New York Times reporter who journeyed to the jungle and came out with the story of Castro.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Earlier this week, nearly every news outlet served up footage secretly recorded by the Humane Society of the United States of the Hallmark Westland Meat Company. What you're hearing is the sound of a cow being dragged by one leg and shoved by a forklift. Essentially, it's a video of an animal being tortured. It was a downer cow, so-called because it was too injured or diseased to stand. It's illegal to use downer cows in the meat supply because they pose higher risks of salmonella and mad cow disease. The Humane Society has released far more gruesome tape of mistreated animals, but this particular one had legs, resulting in the recall of 143 million pounds of beef, the largest in U.S. history. This despite the fact that much of this meat has already been eaten without reported illness. So what made the press take notice? Wayne Pacelli is the CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. He says the video had just the right amount of violence.
While it was very hard to watch and while it was very moving and emotionally gripping, it wasn't bloody, it wasn't gory, and it didn't have that kind of revulsion factor that makes you turn away and say, I just can't bear to see it or hear it. It was in that fine middle ground between being very emotionally compelling but not going too far overboard.
Now, you at the Humane Society have some substantial experience with far more gruesome footage that you haven't been able to get on television very easily. A story can actually be too awful to get any play.
I think that's true. And what we do see with the Canadian seal killing, where 300 or 350,000 baby seals are killed, as you see, you know, bloody ice, and you see these beautiful little pups killed. I think for some members of the media, it's too much. Now, that footage has been aired, but it is closer to the line in terms of acceptable footage. I will say, I think the line is moving a bit. I think during the Michael Vick case, we saw some really extensive airing of dogfighting footage that our investigators had taken as well. It was tough to watch, but if we're going to treat it seriously, we have to look at what's going on in terms of the abuses.
The Humane Society of the United States doesn't necessarily have a dog in the food supply protection fight, but nonetheless, that is the other aspect of this story which made it so take off. The threat to not just consumers, but child consumers because of where this meat was headed.
Without question, Hallmark Westland was the number two supplier to the National School Lunch Program. I think that one of the factors here is the relevance of the story to our daily lives. Most Americans eat meat. They want to know that the product is not adulterated, They want to believe that the animals are not abused during the production, transport, or slaughter process. Here you have something that was driven by the concern for food safety, the health of our children, and the feeling that if I'm going to eat meat, I want to know that the animals are not being abused in the process.
You had a press conference only after the story first broke in the Washington Post. You fed the story to the Post as an exclusive. Why did you go in that direction?
The idea of exclusives, I think, is a dangerous one. We often don't do exclusives because other outlets then get upset. But we did feel that there was truly a strong Washington angle with Congress and an executive agency headquartered here. We did have something new to offer even after the Post broke the story because it was a print outlet and we had really compelling video footage. And I think once that was made available, then it just started to gather steam. And then you just had a subsequent set of actions in response to the investigation that drove the story almost on a daily basis.
Well, clearly you hit the media jackpot on this one and the governmental one. I'm curious, though, if in past episodes where you thought you had a story that was going to capture the imagination of the media and the public, only to discover that you really didn't have the necessary goods.
Well, we're in the press all the time, but the question is, does it really achieve a critical mass? And frankly, most of the stuff that we do does not. You occasionally get the breakout stories, whether it's Michael Vick, whether it's Katrina Pet Rescue, or now the slaughterhouse investigation in Southern California. Canadian Seals has its moments. Dogfighting before Vick, you know, was a compelling story, but it never broke out. People were shocked that anyone was even doing dogfighting. We have a situation in this country of canned hunting. There are 7,000 canned hunting operations where mammals are shot in fenced enclosures for a fee. We've got some really compelling footage. We've got a tremendously abusive, unfair situation. It, you know, occasionally rises to the level of interest, but it goes on every day, and the media pay attention to it episodically.
Wayne, thank you.
Thank you.
Wayne Pacelli is the CEO of the Humane Society of the United States. And now a review of some of the comments you've been leaving on our website. My commentary from last week earned a flurry of emails. The opening gambit came from Kevin McCaig of Davison, Michigan. Quote, I think Bob Garfield's comments on the Republicans' walkout are dead on, and I agree with almost everything he has to say on the president's fear campaign being used to scare us into giving away more civil liberties protections. Having said that, however, I must ask, what in the heck does any of this have to do with the media? On the Media is one of my favorite shows on NPR, but I cringe when I hear pieces that don't fall within the stated purview of the show.
Then Jack from Chicago jumped in with, quote, I think Bob's editorial should have been introduced as such. Then I would forgive his one-sidedness and poor presentation of historical context, both of which devalued this piece.
David Ogden from Walnut Creek, California, disagreed. He wrote, quote, Garfield pinpointed and skewered so many of the fearsome things about Bush-Cheney in his short editorial, it was time well spent for me. On the other hand, Dan Hayes from New York City wrote, stop camouflaging your self-righteous liberal political comments as dealing with the media. This political point of view permeates PBS and especially WNYC and is completely inappropriate for this show and for a national public network. You may be surprised, even shocked, but not everyone agrees with you. You're media critics? You should be the subject of a media critical show.
Finally, Chris Gray from New Haven attempted to wrap up the now multifaceted debate. He wrote, quote, first, I thought it was really odd that this was basically an editorial comment rather than a story. Second, I had no problem with it as a comment on how the manufactured media event was being used to, quote, change the subject of the day's media coverage. The commentary was definitely on the media. Still, I think Bob may have missed another more tangible motive for the walkout. Those who walked out will never have to answer for their vote one way or the other on the contempt of Congress issue. That, I suspect, was the real reason for the balk.
Thanks for the argument. We are paying attention. And keep up the conversation at onthemedia.org.
Cuba's President Fidel Castro resigned Tuesday after ruling for nearly half a century. But for a couple of years before he assumed power, he was assumed to be dead until a crucial interview conducted in the jungle. The story goes like this. It's February 1957. Ruby Phillips, longtime Cuba correspondent for The New York Times, is approached by some men who say that Castro is not dead, but in hiding and seeking to meet with an American journalist. Phillips declined. Cuba had become her home, and she knew she'd be deported. Plus, she had pretty good access to the increasingly repressive Batista regime. Since Castro wasn't likely to win, it didn't seem worth the risk. But she cabled the Times and urged Herbert L. Matthews, former war reporter turned aging editorial writer, to come to Cuba right away. He'd been there before and was eager for adventure. He went. And that's where the story really begins, as New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma relates in his book called The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of The New York Times. When we spoke to DePalma last year, he told us that Matthews was, in a sense, the best and the worst person for the job. He wrote vividly, but had a dangerous tendency to fall in love with the causes and characters he covered.
So when he was covering the Italian invasion of Ethiopia, Abyssinia then, in the early 1930s, he believed that Mussolini was doing a great thing and admitted that for a while he believed in the fascist cause. He later on retracted that. When he covered the Spanish Civil War, he believed that the side that he was covering, which were the loyalists, were the side of righteousness. And then in 1957, he shows up in Cuba and interviews Fidel.
The trip there was so taxing, and he spent all those many hours in the car and trekking through the jungle talking about the great revolutionary cause with the people who were guiding him and protecting him. Therefore, once he sees Fidel, he's ready to fall in love.
Well, it's 6 o'clock in the morning. He's been up all night. He's muddy and cold and dirty. Dawn is just breaking in the Sierra, and Fidel comes through the foliage like some apparition. And Matthews immediately, even in the article, describes him as physically powerful, talks about the glint in his eye, and almost from that moment falls for him.
So what was the kind of stage management that Castro applied to the scene?
They're basically sitting on a log for 3 hours. Castro has it all prepared, and he lays out an image of himself as a young, democracy-loving defender of the Cuban Constitution. He says that he's got a number of men with him, armed with telescopic rifles. They've had a number of major battles. They've got Batista on the run. The truth is, he had 18 men at most. He had one telescopic rifle. He has his brother, Raul, who's second in command, send over someone and say, Comandante, we're getting a report from the second column. Of course, with 18 men, there was no second column. But in defense of Matthews, he had checked with the U.S. Embassy in Havana. They told him hundreds of men. We had run a story the week before citing a figure from the rebel representative in New York saying they had hundreds of men. And our resident correspondent, Ruby Phillips, who had lived in Cuba for 30 years, said, we believe he's up there and has several hundred men behind him.
Well, let's talk about then what happened. Matthews returns to New York. He writes a 3-part series. It's published in the New York Times. Now, Batista was famously censoring the press at the time. And in fact, those papers, when they arrived, literally had the stories clipped out of them.
Mm-hmm.
But an anti-Batista character was dispatched to New York to buy up the papers, clip those stories out, and send them to thousands of very important people in Cuba. So the stories got around and they were talked about.
Absolutely true. I spoke to that man who's still alive. Mario Llerena is the man's name. He's now in his 90s, but he remembered this story very well. He was a supporter of Fidel's. He was called in by another one of the supporters and said, we need you to go on a mission. And the mission is to go to New York, get the articles. He handed him the money for the ticket and a copy of the social registry of Havana.
So they went to a great deal of trouble to get this story to the Cuban people. What was the impact?
Just last week, I spoke to someone who was there at the time. He's now an academic in New York, and he said it was electric. Here was the first real news that he was alive. It was coming from a source outside of Cuba, so it was trusted. And it presented this image, which Castro's image in Cuba at that time was a little bit of a roughneck, kind of a loose cannon. He had gone through a couple of other attempts at overthrowing the government that failed utterly. But here he was being presented as a leader, as a romantic figure. Remember, he was only 30 years old. He was young. He had a beard. He had these men up in the mountains.
So he was made a hero, at least initially, by Matthews. But wasn't Matthews made into something of a hero by Castro as well?
Absolutely. They both became heroes at the beginning. Matthews, remember, 57-year-old editorial writer at the newspaper, one day had to go through the doors of the New York Times on 43rd Street in Manhattan and pass by a demonstration, not protesting anything that he wrote, but supporting the articles that he wrote. So it was a demonstration in his favor. Might have bolstered his ego, but it probably made it pretty embarrassing for him to deal with his colleagues in the paper.
And in fact, you write that he was already in a peculiar position of writing both for the news pages and the editorial pages, a position that no reporter is ever allowed to be in. He kept saying, trust me, I'm a great asset to your paper. But by dint of writing his opinion in one section of the paper and what was ostensibly objective news in another part of the paper, he couldn't be trusted in either section.
It was a dangerous precedent that was set at that point and never repeated. It was a personal relationship he had with the publisher at the time, and they came up with this super correspondent. The New York Times didn't back away from it. In fact, they used his position as editorial writer and correspondent in advertisements at the time, and they were very proud of what he did. When Castro turned and showed that his revolution was intent on becoming a communist revolution, people looked for someone to blame, and Matthews was the target. And he was blamed by Cubans who didn't like Fidel. He was blamed by our United States Senate in congressional hearings. He was blamed by the journalistic community.
Do you think he deserved that blame?
Someone once said, a professor at Stanford, that blaming Matthews for Castro is like blaming the meteorologist for a storm. I don't think I would blame him for what happened, because I think it would have happened anyway. As a correspondent, he was asked to judge what was the truth at that time. It turned out not to be the truth, but even today, 50 years later, people are writing biographies of Castro, and they still can't say with any real authority whether or not Castro was a communist at the time in 1957 that he did the interview. We still don't know.
You defend Matthews quite a lot in this conversation, but it was a dark chapter in the history of American journalism.
Did he make mistakes? Absolutely. Did he do things that the newspaper, the New York Times, should not have allowed through? Absolutely. Do I, as a correspondent and a longtime staff member of the New York Times, feel proud about everything that he did? Absolutely not. What I was simply trying to do was to look at the story behind the myth, and I found that there was far more myth than there was truth to it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
New York Times reporter Anthony DePalma is author of The Man Who Invented Fidel, Castro, Cuba, and Herbert L. Matthews of the New York Times.
6 years of surface prosperity and government corruption, of repression and police brutality, bred explosive discontent. Now Batista has fled. A new leader is on the scene. Fidel Castro, in many ways an unknown quantity in his politics and policies, but certain to be dominant in Cuba's new era, just begun.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Vuolo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Paul Schneider. We also had help from Nadia Zonis, Sasha Evans, Shamil Ahmed, and Andy Lancet. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.